Welcome to Essential Work, exploring the past, present, and future of jobs. This podcast brought to you by the Battle of Homestead Foundation. I'm Nathan Ruggles. Thank you for listening. Each week, we bring you stories and struggles, people and perspectives, interviews and commentaries, all on the world of work yesterday, today, and tomorrow. We look at the most important issues people face on the job through a unique lens of history and time and music. If you're a history buff, if you're curious about what the workplace of the future will look like, if you face your own challenges on the job, if you appreciate context and perspective that helps you better understand our particular moment in time, if you enjoy how music can provide an artistic window into issues, this is the podcast for you. Here in our 11th episode, Larry McCullough and I talk over some of the latest news from our sponsor. The Battle of Homestead Foundation, based here in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is looking to hear from you. That's coming up later, along with his song selection inspired by our feature interview. That feature is from Patty DeMarco. With her 30-year career in energy and environmental policy in both the private and public sector, she regularly addresses labor, environment, and health as she explores reimagining America with her guests. They're all amazing experts and change agents working toward a sustainable future. This time, she takes a look at urban agriculture, community gardens, and more. It's pathways to a new economy that works for all of us. Next up.
Hello, this is Patty DeMarco. I'm your host for our program, Pathways to a New Economy That Works for All of Us. We're exploring today food. Having fresh, healthy food from local sources has become a priority for a lot of people. And today, I'm really thrilled to have my friend Raiden Sorok from Grow Pittsburgh. He is the Director of Community Projects, and he's with me today to talk about urban gardening and community gardening and how it is that we all can have a better and healthier diet if we grow some of our own food and have a lot of other benefits from that as well. Raiden, welcome to our show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah.
It's great to be here.
So tell us a little bit about Grow Pittsburgh. What is it and what does it do and how is it special?
Sure. So we started about 15 years ago, three women urban farmers who were really busy working on their urban farms kept getting a lot of questions from other folks who wanted to do the same thing. And they said, we don't have time to do our farmings. We need to start an organization so that people can go there and ask their questions. So really we started focused on education around how to grow food through workshops, through job training, and also in growing food on urban farm sites to demonstrate how this could be done elsewhere. I came on in 2012 in the community garden program, and that started a little bit later after the school gardens and the production farm sites.
Well, you know, it's really interesting that we have to teach people how to farm now, because I grew up in Pittsburgh when pretty much everybody had a vegetable garden in their backyard or in their side yard or in their wherever they could put it. Because if you didn't grow some of your own food, you didn't get fresh vegetables. And my family back in Italy, they all came to a certain part of Pittsburgh and the whole place looked like little Italy. You know, grapevines growing up to the second floor and fig trees in the backyard and the fruit trees along the borders and the vegetables in the middle. And all the kids were conscripted labor. You'd go around, Aunt Matilda needs you to go pick the, okay, you know, we're canning over in Aunt Bernice's house today. You know? And that kind of family and community-related farming used to be a really important part of Pittsburgh culturally. And it's exciting to me to see this coming back because farmland doesn't have to be vast acres of monocrop in the middle of nowhere. It's really integral to people's existence and to the communities around them. So you really started with that concept of community gardens, right? Where you create community around growing food.
Yeah, I think you touched a lot of really interesting things. I've talked to a lot of people who might be in their 60s, 70s, 80s, and they remember being kids and running around and not paying attention at the time when they were kids to their parents and grandparents and great-grandparents who were telling them to do this and that. But they're like, oh, if I had just paid more attention when they were telling me to run around and do these things, you know, I'd be starting from a different place. But I think that's the kind of story that is really special. And once you kind of get those people talking, they'll realize, oh, actually, you know, I do remember a lot of this stuff. And it's a really good point that you say, like, yeah, it's this stuff, it may have kind of been dormant for a little bit, but it's always been kind of there. And it's just coming back around again. It's definitely not new. It's kind of the oldest thing we can imagine in terms of community building. And it's been really amazing to hear stories from longtime residents of Homewood and Manchester, mm-hmm. of other communities around the city that just say, yeah, there used to be gardens everywhere. We used to pick mm-hmm. fruit on our way to school.
And you can walk around and still see, even if they're not actively gardens now, the vestigial areas that used to be gardens and occasional tree, you know, why is there a pear tree right here in the middle of this place? Well, because you grew your fruit trees on the edges of your gardens, you know? And I think it's true that people kind of long for that connection to the land. And there's a part of you that misses it, even if you don't know it. Mm-hmm. And I find that when you are putting growing things in urban spaces, it's a magnet, right? It draws people to it. There grows a sense of community purpose that you can gather around that common sharing of growing things and sharing of the fruit of the product of the growing.
I really love in talking to a lot of folks over the past 9 years, a lot of people get involved in community gardens because they're like, well, I want to grow food. I need some more exercise. You know, I want to learn some new things. But then they find a big part of what they get out of it is that they meet new people mm-hmm. and they're talking to their neighbors. They're going to connect to their neighbors. And I think critically, they also are learning how to be more civically engaged in their mm-hmm. neighborhoods, and especially in the smaller municipalities around the city of Pittsburgh, where, you know, if there's an issue at the garden, a lot of times the place to go is to the borough manager, Department of Public Works, and get their help with it. And then you find that maybe some of those other issues that people were having in the community that they needed some help from local government, maybe those things get fixed because now they have those personal relationships, and that goes a long way.
So it's part of your social justice values of community participation and social justice is kind of woven into the Grow Pittsburgh ethic and values. I found that very exciting. And to see that you can actually build people's interconnectedness by shared activity around growing food.
Yeah, that points to kind of a bigger transition we had at the organization, probably about 5 years ago, where we kind of refocused our mission to be people focused. You know, I think for a really long time, for about the first 8 to 10 years of the organization, you know, we're really focused on growing food, growing spaces, growing. And for my department, the community garden team, really for the first many years of our program, the primary focus was on building new spaces. And we've started to transition more, I'd say about half focused on new growing spaces and about half now focused on sustaining the gardens that do exist because we know how much support they may need long term. And I think also around that time, that's when we really started to shift to say, okay, our mission is really about people and what are the social justice issues that are barriers to growing food and how can we really focus on that, make sure that that's a central focus of our work. And I think that that's a lot where that community participation comes into play, where we really want to make sure that the project is driven by local residents, not only because it's the right thing to do, but it just, you have better results when you have people who are right down the street who come to the garden frequently and then draws in other people and they know the story about what was there before and all that. It just makes for a richer experience and just wildly more successful to have that level of participation.
That's interesting. And you have how many plots are you now managing as community gardens?
Our program works in each garden comes on for about 2 years and we work with them in that time. Currently, we're working with about 4 to 8 gardens, various levels of engagement on our end. And we've helped to start about 40 gardens throughout Allegheny County over the last 10 or so years. But we know that there's nearly 130 community gardens, school gardens, urban agriculture projects throughout the county. And we're trying to connect as best we can with them to connect them to each other and also to resources.
Mm-hmm. So these are on private property mostly. These aren't necessarily public land, or are there some that are public land?
There's actually quite a lot that are on public land. Like, that's actually a requirement of our program. So those 40 for sure should be on either nonprofit or municipally owned land, so that there's a level of accountability to that space. There's a lot of great projects on private property for sure. Mm-hmm. I think that there's, just in terms of our program, we want to make sure that there's a group of people that have some ownership and buy-in into that space. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there's all kinds for sure.
Mm-hmm. And what have you found the most satisfying results of these projects? What has really been the biggest success story that you have from urban farming?
Oh, wow. There's so many great ones. I want to shout out my friends at the Duquesne Community Victory Garden, because I just think that what they've been able to do there is just pretty amazing. That's at the Presbyterian Church there. They actually were excellently able to get a grant from the Presbytery to pay a coordinator to help with a lot of their early efforts. And I think that really made a huge difference. But I think that the key factor was that the church was already providing a lot of programming to the community. They had a free store, they had a meal program, they had a lot of activities, and the garden really folded in so well with what they were doing and then created even more possibility for an engagement. And they have plots where people can rent their own plot. So they have people on a regular basis taking care of their own space, but they also have a significant portion of the garden that is collectively grown, so that they are growing produce to be donated through the free store, through their meal programs there. They also just know how to have fun. They had a kind of hilariously competitive chili cook-off at one point, and they have just a lot of ways to engage the kids and older folks. They created an area that's a lot more accessible than most gardens, in that you can run a wheelchair up to some of the garden plots. Mm. So I just feel like they've done a great job of kind of knowing who's in the community and how to reach them as best as possible. A lot of people, I think, don't get involved in community gardens because they think, or they know, you know, they're certain that they don't know how to garden. They're intimidated, or they don't know those people very well, and it's just hard to get involved. But I think when garden groups have events that don't have anything to do with gardening mm-hmm. at that site, it just helps create a level of comfort and positive experience in the space that then can lead to more good outcomes.
Mm-hmm. And you've also been supporting urban farming, right?
That's a big aspect of our farm education and production team mm-hmm. in growing at several sites, including our biggest kind of newest project at Garden Dreams in Wilkinsburg after 20 years. And this was actually started by one of the women, Mindy Schwartz, who started Grow Pittsburgh back in the day. She brought up this business for 20 years, and then we got the business from her. We are going to be growing two greenhouses on that site to expand there. So our production is expanding right now. We've done a lot in terms of youth job training, which is very exciting, getting them involved in markets around the city, creating food access where there might be little or none. And there's some really great opportunities there with the overlap in job training and food access and in demonstration and being able to get that experience, become experts in growing and be able to help other new urban farmers come up and do what they want to do as well.
Mm-hmm. And Pittsburgh has quite a few urban farmer markets now. I think at some point people noted that we have about the capability within 100 miles of Pittsburgh to grow food to feed the city, because we have good ground, we have good land. If we preserve the fertile land for feeding people, we really have a tremendous resource and capacity here. But the urban areas, we do have food deserts in our community. And I was amazed. I was doing some research for a regenerative agriculture paper, and I found that 12 states out of the United States have food insecure areas as a predominant feature, more than 50% of their land. And I was surprised that some of those are farming states. They have wide open spaces growing monocrop, and there isn't food for people. And, you know, we also have areas where, because the markets are not, the grocery stores are not located where the people are not having access to fresh food, to a variety of foods. They might have a very limited kind of a shopping experience. And urban agriculture has really stepped into that as a significant force for making food accessible to people and also making it a job opportunity. I think it's exciting to see that people can look at farming, even in an urban area, as a career path. And how can we help to foster not just the knowing how to farm, but also the acquiring of the land. I mean, having ability to own farming and own farmland as a career path, because I think this is really where the wealth of the community can be invested in local activities, where you can have people have a pathway to getting their own space to farm.
Yeah, I want to shout out the folks at the National Young Farmers Coalition who are working locally in Pennsylvania to help new and beginning farmers do that work and locate land. There's a lot of great organizations working to help people do that through PASA, through Penn State, through the Department of Agriculture, which is very supportive in Pennsylvania. And there's recently been created an official state apprenticeship program for starting in farming. And these are all really great steps. There's going to be a massive transition of ownership of farmland in the next coming decades. And we really need to be ready with funding and with support and resources to help new and beginning farmers take over that land. I think that if you talk to any aging farmers that are needing to sell or needing to do something different or can't farm anymore, they would love to see that land continue to be farmed, but the money just isn't there. But I think what I hope is that the real focus is on the value of that land staying farmland. And I think you touch on a really good point about this, looking at this 100-mile radius, is that urban agriculture and rural agriculture are not diametrically opposed. They're It's all connected because the rural farmers bring a lot of their food to sell in the cities, and that's a major lifeline. And I think what's unique about urban farmers is that they have to be connected with the community because they're just right into people's backyards and they need to know what's going on. But I think what you're talking about with this land ownership piece is that we really need to elevate the value of that land, staying green space, staying farmland. I mean, it took millions of years for farmland soil to become as rich and wonderful as it is. And, you know, that could be wiped out in a year with one development and then starting totally from scratch. So that's a major challenge in urban farming lands.
So this is a policy issue that we should, I know that there were some zoning changes in Pittsburgh that enabled farming in the city limits, even to the point of having goats and chickens and bees. And we adopted that ordinance in my community as well, minus the goats. But I know people have rented the goats to come help clear off stuff.
They're so lovely. Yeah.
But the thing is, we have to put a resource together to allow people to buy, to get loans for purchase farms for the purpose of farming. And you're right, the demographic of the farmers is 65 and older is more than half of them. And so the turnover and not having good ways to help finance the maintenance of farming, so it will default to a developer of some sort. And right. The tax situation is such that if you have a building on the property or a housing development or something, you're going to have a higher tax into the coffers of the town or the city than if it stayed as farmland. So there are a number of things that need to be aligned with the values of preserving living ground. Fertile ground is one of our life support systems. And it has a couple of other benefits. You can sequester carbon in that fertile ground in ways that you can't in ground that is highly chemically produced. But people who farm by hand, especially urban farmers, organic farmers, they're incorporating a lot of carbon material into the ground and sequestering that out of the air and keeping it in the ground instead of in the air, which is a way of helping to address the climate situation that we have by sequestering carbon through nature.
Yeah, it's really a great opportunity.
Yeah. So if you can preserve land that has, I don't know, 12 or 15 inches of topsoil that has been cultivated and protected and enriched for years and years and years, you know, somebody puts a parking lot on top of that, and you, like you said, you have to start from scratch all over again. And it has a value that we don't count as appropriately as we should.
Right. I mean, that's one thing, kind of for better or for worse, in that community gardens and green spaces, either they are kind of going along with the curve of possibly increasing property values, or they themselves are driving an increase in property values, which is in so many of the areas along the Mon Valley and in the region in general that are really hurting for any kind of income, you know, having a green space that makes it more exciting for people to buy and fix up houses around that space mm-hmm. and live there long term is actually a really great thing for those communities. And also it's a double-edged sword because you want to make sure that the people that's put in the sweat equity and work into starting those spaces are able to stay and reap the benefits of making their neighborhood cool, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I think that, you know, what you're saying with there's a lot of policy and zoning tweaks that need to happen and major changes that need to happen in order to prioritize green space, not only for sequestering carbon and just for environmental benefit in general, but also for stormwater management, for reducing health inequities and asthma rates, cooling the city, so many great benefits that are really valuable. I mean, we've been able to put a value on a single tree in a neighborhood for what it does monetarily. And that's been a lot of the, you know, what I hope the impact of our work over the years is just really showing the value of these community garden spaces, showing the value of urban agriculture spaces, not always the tangible value, but also the community impact as well.
Yeah. You heal the land and you heal the people. When you can maintain fertile ground, you also contribute to the security of the community. You have better environmental conditions and you have a much more just and equitable kind of a solution. You have people have access to things. You can grow, you know, Asian vegetables, you can grow bok choy and snow peas, and you can grow chili peppers and onions and jalapenos.
That's a good point. That, like, yeah, it's so much about not only the staples that people need to cook whatever dinner they're going to make on any night of the week, but also, and maybe even interestingly, learning about so many different kinds of flowers and vegetables and fruits that many different cultures and communities around this region are growing that are so hard to get otherwise, or so much more expensive to get in the store because they have to be imported. And then to hear people tell stories of this bitter melon and how it's cooked in a really important dish for this community, or the powerful impact of growing okra in the African American community, and just the amazing, you know, the stories and the power behind seeds and what people are growing and the stories that they tell about those. I mean, that's the piece around healing as well, where it's like, yeah, we need to grow food not only to connect more with our bodies, with our communities in the present, but also connecting with our ancestors in the past and having an opportunity for those kids to begrudgingly come to the garden and learn things whether they want to or not.
When we were taking my parents' house apart after my dad died, one of my little nieces went through the garden and collected all the seeds. Mm. She took, you know, Rose of Sharon seeds and rose hips and seeds from the fennel and the dill and, you know, all the seeds that she could find. And she gave us each little packages of them for Christmas that year.
That's a really cool idea.
It was like, this is from my dad's garden. And we made wreaths out of the grapevines. And I think having that generation to generation knowledge, we almost lost it, right? We almost lost it. But I think to have this new generation of people, young farmers and people learning from the older people in the community and restoring that connection, not just to the land, but to the cultures and now cross cultures, you know, because you can cross fertilize so nicely when you're growing things next to each other in plots and you'll see different kinds of things in different gardens and people talk about it. Oh, well, this is some of mine. You can have some of this and I'll give you some of that, you know, and it just naturally becomes a really enriching experience that brings people together over food, which is really one of the oldest arts there are, right? You sit down and
yeah, absolutely.
Not in times of COVID, but soon again, right?
Soon again, yeah. Yeah, we're all longing for that, I know.
We need to let people know how they can find out more about what you do and where they can go to get more information about this wonderful opportunity.
Sure. So I suggest folks check out our website, growpittsburgh.org. We've got a lot of really great resources on there, both for backyard gardeners, for community gardeners, and also some more specific resources for urban agriculture farmers as well. We do have currently, we're going to be starting to hire again for our next season's apprentices and interns. And so folks that are looking to get started in this field, I definitely encourage you to check that out. And also there are, you know, I mentioned before, there are 130 gardens in the county. So we operate a map on our website. So if you have a garden that's not on there, please do add that. But if you're looking for a garden nearby to you, then take a look at that. I encourage you to reach out to them. Just know that they're often volunteer run and they might, you know, be persistent and maybe show up so you can talk to someone on site to learn more about how to get involved. And there's, you know, obviously schools are managing in a different way right now, but there's an amazing wealth of community gardens at schools, and kids are just so incredible in those spaces where they make watermelon salad with lots of different herbs at school. And then they come home and they're like, oh, we need to make this. And their parents are like, oh, okay, you want to eat this new thing? Great. So we're very excited to get back in the classrooms again. If your school doesn't have a community garden there, reach out to us and we can help with getting that started. And come take a look at some of our sites. We've got volunteer opportunities and tour opportunities as well.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, is there anything else you'd like to add before we end today?
Yeah, I guess we really talked up so many of the wonderful things about community gardens and urban agriculture. And I also just want to acknowledge that so many of them may be really struggling right now with, they don't have their usual volunteer groups, or leaders of the garden may be struggling financially or with their health or with their families and childcare and everything like that. So just know that we're here. We understand the problems that you're going through, and we're going to get through this. Every garden has challenges. And, you know, if you need to be a little bit more fallow to just make it through, that's totally fine. It's still about activating the space and keeping it low maintenance, but keeping it a place that people know that they can safely congregate outside, which is something that we need so much right now.
Excellent. Really true. Well, I thank you so much for everything you do and for Grow Pittsburgh being part of our city and part of our future. And I thank you so much and I wish you all the best.
Thank you so much. It's been great talking with you.
And this is Nathan Ruggles here with you again. We're going to finish up this episode, as we do, with a quick review of the latest news from the Battle of Homestead Foundation, along with a song. And that means we need our podcast music expert, Larry McCullough, to be here with us. Larry, it's always great to have you here.
Well, it's great to be here. Thanks.
And we've also just had this great interview from Patty DeMarco, along with her guests. She always does an excellent job. And Larry always takes such great inspiration from interviews such as hers here in the program. We should say, Larry, you are also the Battle of Homestead Foundation Communications Manager, which means you're the guy that we turn to hear about the latest from the organization. As far as events coming up for this year, that list is still being determined, right?
Correct. Program committee has gotten some really good proposals, still looking for more. And if you look at the programs we had last year, they were stellar, and they all involved some sort of local connection, Western Pennsylvania, to the labor movement, labor heritage. Of course, it was a centenary, the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment, giving American women the legal right to vote at the federal level. And so there was that. And that had some local tie-ins here as well. So that's really the kind of programs we're looking for. People that have done really great things in this area and people who want to share that knowledge.
And some of that past programming, you can check that out on the YouTube channel, right?
Correct.
And we're looking to get some more of that up as time goes on.
Yeah, of course, we had Charlie's Monday Marker, the video tour series of Pittsburgh labor landmarks. And there were 24 of them done, 10 to 15 minute videos. And they're all on the Battle of Homestead Foundation channel on YouTube. And going to be some more video tours of labor sites in the future.
Yeah, I know last time we talked about episode 22, but since then we've had a couple more that folks should be sure to check out.
Right. Yeah, there was the Frances Perkins when she came to town, came to Homestead, to Pittsburgh, talked, the first Secretary of Labor in the United States, and then to Pittsburgh working class sports. Pittsburgh has always been a big sports town, and its initial support of all these sporting leagues really came from working people. And Charlie's Monday Marker, episode 24 there, goes into some of the history of that.
Excellent. And so Charlie's Monday Marker is taking a bit of a break, right? But we hope to be able to look forward to more of that in the future coming from Charlie McCullister. local labor history expert and author. And because the book that was written with him and Howard Scott was more than just 24 markers, correct?
I think there were 62, so there's still quite a few to be done. And he organized them thematically last time, and it really, really helps. You know, you see a marker somewhere and you think, you know, even if you sort of understand what the event was, you don't really have the whole background. And that's what Charlie was able to do, is really get into the background and then relate to today, which is pretty impressive.
That's right. It really brings him to life, right?
Yep, yep.
I mean, because, you know, you see those markers and it's a short paragraph, but he really delves in. And I don't know about you, I would look forward to hearing about many more of the markers from the book. And that'll be possible. Certainly the organization, I think, is looking to make that happen here in 2021. And that can happen if folks like the folks listening to this program or members support the programming, right?
Yep, yep, definitely.
And it doesn't take much to be a member.
No, to be really frank, it's $10 if you're a student, $20 if you're a senior or underemployed, and $30 just for a full membership. And we have other donation categories as well if you want to add to that. But yeah, basically $30, you know.
For the year, yeah.
Yeah, an entire year.
Yeah. And obviously the organization is happy to take larger amounts as well. It supports this podcast. It supports the organization. It supports all the programs that, Larry, you've been telling us about from the beginning with the podcast that the organization's been hosting and will continue to be hosting and making available to folks this coming year.
Yeah, definitely check the website. The donations membership page has all the information. Very easy. You can do it, you know, PayPal or credit card, or you can mail a check.
Yeah, we'll take it however you want to give it. That's for sure.
Yes, indeed.
So, and you can also support this podcast as well through that. And coming up for our next episode, you'll hear from Charlie McCullister as well as Rosemary Trump. They'll be with us with their monthly wrap-up, working over time, and it's going to be a year wrap-up for this next episode, talking about looking back in the year in terms of this tumultuous year, this year of so many stories, so much news, so many things impacting working families and working people and the labor movement. They'll be taking a look at that and bringing that up to the present and then looking to what are we going to see here in the future for working folks. They are two excellent commentators who have a lot of knowledge to share, and we'll look forward to hearing from them, taking a look at the past, the present, and the future as we do here on the program. So that's what's in store for us here coming up next episode. We welcome your ideas as well for what we would have here in 2021 on the podcast. You can always give us a call on our listener line at 412-326-9435 or shoot us an email, comments@essentialworkpodcast.org. And you can find both those contacts in the episode description. And of course, our podcast website is essentialworkpodcast.org. And you can check us out there along with all of our past episodes. And while you're at it, if you would, it helps us out a great deal if you like us on Apple Podcasts, because that'll help introduce us to other listeners and also give us a nice review. 5 stars would be great. So we are going to get to Larry's song selection here in a moment. We do want to give some thanks out to the folks that helped make this podcast possible. Our logo was created by Brittany Sheets. If you'd like to see more of her work, you can go to bsheetscreative.com. Of course, our theme song, original song, written and recorded by Jason Kendall, his website, jasonkendallproductions.com. And we always turn to Angela Bachman for any time we need additional help with editing or audio engineering. She does great work, and her website is thatsoundgirl.com. So let's wrap it up here now. You've done great work, Larry, in picking songs that really reflect so many of the themes and issues with this program. And this next one is no exception.
Well, there have always been a lot of original songs in the labor music tradition about food, farming, food culture, people that work in food processing. Some of the really interesting ones, of course, were created in the 1960s and 70s. And these were songs that spotlighted the United Farm Workers movement in the American Southwest and eventually around the country. Typically, they were created by Mexican-American musicians that used traditional Mexican song forms, some of them stemming from the 1800s, rancheras or corridos, some of the genres that were among the most popular.
So and going back quite a ways, we're talking, the inspiration, right?
Actually, even further than that, a corrido is the Spanish word for ballad, and it's a narrative ballad with roots going back to medieval Spain. Very similar to like you think of old English or old Irish ballads.
Okay.
They were really happening. This form was happening all over Europe. In this country, the corrido was adapted by Spanish-speaking people, especially northern Mexico, and then the American Southwest in the late 1800s, and eventually spread to Mexican-Americans living here. And very much like the early ballads in the British Isles traditions, corridos are usually composed anonymously, transmitted by word of mouth.
Okay.
Of course, that changed with radio and records. And their main function really was to commemorate events or people, some kind of cultural experience of epic proportion, basically, something that it was basically history through song. And so then the labor movement corridos that were composed in the 60s and 70s, they told the story of this movement, the United Farm Workers Movement, from the migrant worker and the union organizer point of view, which was perhaps were points of view that were not being seen in the mainstream media of print or broadcast.
Sure, prior to that time, really. Mm-hmm. So the music helped bring their story to the fore. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, the people would write corridos about strikes, marches, general working conditions, and then also about some of the great leaders like Cesar Chavez, who dedicated his career to fighting for decent working and living conditions for farm workers. So at a certain point, there was a song called Corrido de Cesar Chavez. And there are actually some variants of this. The first one that we know of was composed in 1968 by a fellow named Eduardo Lalo Guerrero. And he was an Arizona-born musician who was born in 1916. And he's regarded as the father of Chicano music. He had an amazing career recording and all kinds of media all the way up to his death in 2005.
So Chicano being Mexican Americans.
Yes. And he wrote Corrido de Cesar Chavez after he read a newspaper account of one of Chavez's first public fast. He, you know, I mean, it worked for Gandhi to get some attention and human interest. And Cesar Chavez started doing that. First one was in 1968. It lasted 25 days. And
25 days.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's pretty incredible. I fasted for a cause once myself, but it certainly wasn't 25 days.
So Lalo Guerrero wrote this song about it, and he recorded it more with a mariachi feel, more with a traditional orchestra feel, you know, with trumpets, and had an accordion on there. So he had kind of a mix of older and more traditional styles. And then in 1970, there was another Corrido de Cesar Chavez that was written by Rumel Fuentes. And this is more of a real recruiting song. The first song, Corrido, was more about, you know, what a great guy Chavez was as a leader. Okay. This one was really sort of talking about what the farm worker movement is and why people should join it. I'll give you a little translation in English.
So beyond just the man himself, it was talking about the larger movement that he was helping to lead.
Yeah. And so Fuentes Corrido starts out, and again, this is an English translation. What's your secret, Cesar Chavez? What have you given your people that those who were stooped over have now raised their heads? The weariness in their breasts is reflected in sad eyes, the brutal work of the field enslaves even the mind. Men, children, and women labor beneath the sun. How much does the rancher profit? How much do the workers get paid? We do not ask for charity, only a decent wage, so demands Cesar Chavez for the benefit of the people. Without anger or violence, organize without delay. For if we sow the seed, there will be something to reap. Obviously, it sounds much more, you know, lyrical in Spanish, but that was the corrido. And again,
incredible. That message is just powerful.
Yeah. And again, this is a musical style that everybody who heard it would have understood, would have grown up with. Mm-hmm. And it has roots as a sort of a way to use music to really tell a story and kind of rouse people to action. And Fuentes was an interesting guy. He was born in Eagle Pass, Texas, which is right across from Piedras Negras in Coahuila. He was born in 1943. He died very young, 1986. And he was just a school teacher. He just started out as a normal working person in his local school system. But the United Farm Worker Movement really roused him, and he started writing songs. And of course, he grew up singing.
He was a teacher at the time.
Yeah. And, you know, he grew up with, obviously in his home, there were Mexican-American songs, but he also, you know, heard Bob Dylan and the Byrds and Joan Baez and, you know, all these current contemporary protest songwriters. And he just started using those techniques in his older Mexican tradition.
So kind of melding that older tradition with the inspiration from that era of the 60s. Then.
Yeah. And he, like I say, he died in the mid 80s, but he influenced an entire generation of political songwriters in the Southwest. And the version we're going to hear is from a trio called Los Pingüinos del Norte, Penguins of the North.
That's the name of the band.
That's the name of the band.
Penguins in the North. Okay.
They had a sense of humor. They were from Nuevo Laredo.
I guess. Yeah.
And Piedras Negras.
Okay.
It was a trio, and it had an accordion, the lead singer, Ruben Castillo Juarez. And you'll also hear the bajo sexto, which is a six-string Mexican guitar with very heavy strings, and the tolocoche, which is a slightly modified acoustic string bass. And again, they're singing in that música norteña, that kind of northern Mexico borderland music style that, again, we've all kind of heard it, and we think maybe – you know, where does it come from? It actually comes from a specific area and has specific influences.
So the trio, you said, is a guitar, a bass guitar.
And an accordion.
And an accordion.
Through a button accordion. And this recording comes from a two-album set, which was the soundtrack for two movies, Chulas Fronteras and Del Mero Corazon, which were two documentary films on the music and the culture of the border by ethnographic filmmaker Les Blank. And you probably at some point seen a Les Blank film at some point. Mm-hmm. He made close to 40 films on American roots and ethnic music, blues, jazz, gospel, polka, Cajun, Zydeco. He did a Tambourism film, Hawaiian, old time Appalachian, every one of them. And they're really up
close. Appalachian, so all over.
Oh, yeah. I mean, okay. He just basically covered American ethnic cultures as rootsy as he could get. And every Les Blank film basically has like food, music, dancing, crafts, some history, a little bit of spiritual traditions, whatever that might be, then that context, public celebrations, and lots of amazing local nature scenes. Basically just really tries to get the cultural experience of that place and those people through their music, but also the traditions that
this particular documentary?
This was made in 19, it was released in 1976. 76. So there are some amazing musicians in the two movies, some from very early older ones from the 1920s and 30s who made 78 records and then kind of lay fallow for a while, then came back in the 70s, and then a lot of new people that are still making music. So yeah, definitely check those out.
So this particular song that was from the documentary, his documentary, was this trio performing the song written by
Fuentes, Rumel Fuentes. Yeah. Okay. And they're still around too, also, I think, in some form.
The trio.
Yeah.
The penguin trio.
Yeah. Los Pingüinos. And we should really note also that the United Farm Workers was accepted into the AFL-CIO in 1972. They really made an impact. And it's still very active and working for a safe and just food supply for all of us. And people are still creating these corridos also. I mean, obviously, there was a boom time in the 60s, 70s, but people still involved in that movement who have this traditional music in their background from Mexico and Mexico America. They are still making some great music there.
Excellent. And I have to say, you know, you mentioned those lyrics, just so powerful, but the idea of that seed, you know, coming back to this whole idea around agriculture and such an apropos sort of idea that by planting a seed, not just in the work that they were doing every day, right?
Right.
But also this idea of planting a seed of fighting for justice.
Yeah.
Right. And as part of a movement. That's fantastic. So you have a sample for us, correct?
Yes. Here's a short audio clip of Corrido de Cesar Chavez, recorded in 1976. It is courtesy of the Strachwitz Frontera Collection of Mexican and Mexican-American recordings at UCLA in Los Angeles.
Del campo, esclaviza hasta la mente.
2021 has been a year of transition for all of us. At the Battle of Homestead Foundation, they have discovered new ways to advance their mission of heritage, education, and social action. They expanded their educational outreach to include a weekly online tour of people's history locations through the Charlie's Monday Marker video series, as well as far-reaching discussion of social and economic trends with the podcast Essential Work, The Past, Present, and Future of Jobs. They presented 7 timely online public panels featuring nationally known authors and historians. Topics included workforce shifts from heavy industry to healthcare, the women's suffrage movement, uprooted immigrant neighborhoods, protest songs in today's civil action movements, the 1921 Battle of Blair Mountain, historical roots of today's social philanthropy, and Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania's world-famous city steps. They establish a professionally archived labor history collection, thousands of documents, photos, recordings, and remembrances of labor history spanning decades. They co-sponsored the Blair Mountain Centennial in West Virginia, honoring a long neglected part of U.S. history with a landmark Labor Day weekend of events. They built a new and more accessible website, which you should check out at battleofhomestead.org. They did all this with help, the essential support of all the individuals like you who enjoyed the programming, appreciate the hard work of the citizens, workers, educators, and historians that make it happen, and value their mission to preserve, interpret, and promote a people's history focused on the significance of the dramatic labor conflict at Homestead, Pennsylvania in 1892. In 2022, they'll present a new round of thought-provoking programming. Membership, along with special donations, is essential to their success. Annual membership is only $30, $20 for retirees or the underemployed, and just $10 for students. Join now at battleofhomestead.org. You can also choose to contribute at any of a number of special donor levels, and donations are tax deductible. Membership also provides multiple free admissions to a variety of historical museums and sites in the greater Pittsburgh area. Check out the details at battleofhomestead.org. As this singular year comes to a close, while we still may have much to be thankful for, we also all see the urgent necessity of doing more to share our progressive labor history to a wider audience and inspire a new generation of activists and organizers. Your membership and engagement ensures that the Battle of Homestead Foundation will continue to do just that. Show your support today at battleofhomestead.org. In solidarity, BHF thanks you and wishes you good health, positive spirits, and both peaceful and joyous days ahead.